at least in the ideal form. And the wealthier Athenians at this time owned huge estates of slaves. We hear of Nicias, for example, leasing 2,000 slaves to the Athenian government. So he must have had a huge supply of his own slaves. Now, I don't want to, again, confuse the ideal world of the Greeks with the reality. The fact surely is, and there's plenty of evidence of this from the law speeches of the 4th century, that there were many farmers, many Athenian citizens who still lived on the land, who were hard-working, and in fact not all the farming was actually going to be done by slaves. But what I'm talking about here is the ideal world emerging in the 5th and the 4th century. We're talking here about the mentality of the Greeks, if you will, that very complicated and complex web of values and assumptions and attitudes that make up the outlook of the Greeks. And here, again, we can see a theme that we've followed a few times in these lectures. Just as not every woman was physically locked up in the back room, and there probably were women in the agora, and just as not every Greek adult male was a homosexual, but it was an activity in aristocratic circles, so too there were surely Athenians farming, but the ideal was that you didn't have to, that someone else would do the work for you, and that with that free time you would then pursue the activities of a citizen. In later ages we might call these the activities of a gentleman or the activities of a nobleman, but here in Athens they're the activities of a citizen. So slavery makes possible skole, and skole makes possible citizenship. Now, I think that in a very interesting way, the operations, the mental operations that we see at work here, persist into our own time and into our own culture. And I'm clearly not talking here about attitudes towards labour or towards slavery, but rather towards culture. And I invite you to consider this for a moment. In our own culture, there is a fairly straightforward distinction between what is normally termed high culture and low culture. Instances of the former of high culture would include things like opera or ballet or paintings at an exhibit such as the Delacroix exhibit currently playing in Philadelphia. While on the other hand, there are a number of forms of culture that we commonly call low culture, such as weaving, quilting, folk music, folk dancing. And if we ask ourselves what the distinction between these is, and clearly there are many influences over the course of time from the Renaissance onwards and even earlier, but there is a kind of basic distinction between those that I think in some ways harks back to the Greeks. We've somehow absorbed the notion that high culture is the culture that is associated with leisure time. It's culture that is expensive, it's culture that you pay for with your work. On the other hand, there are other types of culture which are in fact the same as work or grow out of work. The kind of culture that are not high activities but are done simply by people as part of their daily lives. Quilts are used on people's beds originally. Folk dancing is not something that you pay or that you see at court, but something rather that people are doing when they're having a party as a result of bringing in the harvest. It seems to me that in our attitude, distinguishing between high culture and low culture, what we've done is we've inherited this belief of the Greeks that work pays for leisure, and that therefore the culture which you didn't have to pay for and the culture that wasn't part of the leisure time that you paid for with your work is really somehow not as important and not as valuable. To me, slavery takes us to the absolute paradox then of Greek culture. It is this paradox, namely that the classical civilization undoubtedly did produce a magnificent culture. We still marvel at it today. But none of that culture would have been possible had it not been for the existence at every level of Athenian society and throughout Greek history of a class of slaves.